I'm Steve Chaney. I'm the CEO of the American Security Project, and I'm pleased to see everybody here. Of course, the day when it's 70 degrees and sunny outside, spring, I'm just amazed you're not at the golf course. But anyway, we've got some really great speakers and a great topic today. But let me lay some ground rules first. This is on the record, so anything you say can and will be held against you. So you're welcome to quote. If you get cell phones, things that are going to go beep in the night, if you could please mute them or turn them off, I'd be appreciative. ASP is a unique organization. If you're not familiar, I encourage you to go on our website. We take on topical national issues with a national security slant, and certainly energy security is one of our plank issues, and we're deeply concerned about it, as I know you all are here as well. We look at it from the perspective that if we could get ourselves off of our dependence on oil or fossil fuels, we'd be so much better off. And there are a lot of ways to do that, not the least of which are biofuels. We're going to come out with a major paper here in the next 2 weeks that Andrew Holland has authored, talking about energy choices and energy alternatives. So I encourage you to stay tuned on our website. It's a long treatise, but it talks about alternatives and ways we think we can improve our security through energy independence. But today we're here to talk about biofuels, and we've got some real experts with us. I have a senior fellow on our staff, Andrew Holland, who does our energy work. I want to thank everybody here, particularly want to thank Senator Warner. Thank you for coming, sir. I know you have a distinct interest in here, and it's good to see a Marine in the audience. with that, I'm going to turn it over to Andrew.
Great. Thank you, General. I'll just briefly introduce the topic here and introduce our speakers, and then I'll quickly turn it right over. The topic of today's briefing is Air Force and Navy progress on renewable jet fuels. And the reason for hosting this is that ASP is beginning a program on biofuels. What is going on in biofuels? This will be a progress towards a white paper and we hope a larger program down the road. So keep an eye on this, and I'm going to be using everything that we say today to write that paper. So with that, I'll briefly introduce our two speakers and say, with a flip of the coin, the first speaker will be Commander Jim Goudreau, Director of Navy Energy Coordination Office. He has a 21-year career so far in the Navy as a supply and logistics officer. He currently serves for the last 8 months, I believe he said, is in Navy Energy Coordination Office under Admiral Cullum. We're very happy to have him here. And then Carol Ann Beda has over 20 years as a civil servant in the Air Force, and she is the Director of Energy Policy in the Deputy Secretary for Energy.
Assistant
Deputy Secretary. Got to make sure you get all that right in the Pentagon, I know. And I'll just, with that, I'll just ask each of you to keep it to about 15 or 20 minutes so we have, I know we have a great audience here who is very engaged on this subject and will want to ask questions. And after their presentations, I'll encourage you all to ask questions, and we can go from there. So with that, Commander Goudreau.
Andrew, thank you very much. General, thank you for the invitation. Senator Warner, as always, it is an honor to see you supporting the cause, serving the nation in uniform and out of uniform for so many years. We thank you and we appreciate that service. The first thing and the second thing and the last thing that I'll say is that alternative fuel development for the Navy is not about being green. It's about combat capability only. It starts with combat capability, it ends with combat capability. Our job is not to save the world, our job is to protect the nation and do our nation's bidding to go into harm's way if needed. We use 1.26 billion gallons of fuel every year to power the fleet. 1.26 billion gallons. The cost for that fuel varies anywhere from $4 to $5 billion a year. Now, I say $4 to $5 billion not because we're bad at budgeting. We're just bad at guessing what the market price for that petroleum product will be. We've seen instances over the last few years where, due to market volatility and price fluctuations, we would see almost a $1 billion increase to the cost for our operations during year of execution. For those of you that are familiar with the budget cycle in DC, you don't just get more money within a year of execution. You have to trade something. We've depended upon OCO funding over the last 10 years to be able to damper some of that volatility and to account for that. OCO is going away. Starting this year and into the future years, every time we pay more for a barrel of oil, we're going to trade that. We're going to trade that with a loss in steaming days. We're going to trade that with a loss in flying hours. We're going to trade that with a loss in acquisition for material to support the fleet and maintain it in the readiness state that we require it to do the mission at any moment's notice. The impact of the training and acquisition is unacceptable. We import $300 billion of crude petroleum every year, and we bring that in from various countries all over the world, many of whom are not our best friends, many of whom who don't agree with our policy, even if they are our allies of one sort or another. And as a nation, we consume 25% of the world's petroleum with 4% of the world's population. That's already an unsustainable pattern. If you take a look at what's happening with the Chindia effect and rest of world and the increasing consumption across the world, that increasing demand coupled with decreasing supply means only one thing. Cheap oil is gone. We've seen the last of the cheap oil. Every single year we will face increasing challenges on how to pay for our energy consumption in order to steam the fleet. That'll continue to have impact on our readiness, and ultimately that'll continue to have impact on our economy and national security. It's unsustainable. We can't continue to go down that path. So one of the things that we're doing as part of our overall energy portfolio is taking a look at alternative fuel developments, alternative energy developments. It's a small portion of our portfolio. We've got a decent amount of money invested over the next 5 years, only 5 to 10% of which is devoted to alternative fuel testing and development. Our intent is not to pay a premium for alternative fuels. We simply don't have the budget to do that. But we are leaning forward, and we're going through the testing and certification process for alternative fuels so that when it hits cost parity at market, we will be ready to use that the day we get there. We will be able to safely operate our planes and our ships, continuing to execute the missions that we've been assigned in the past. Now, that's a lengthy process. And if you take a look at what biofuel, what alternative fuel is out there are a range of processes, there are a range of feedstocks, there are a range of approaches. From the Navy perspective, we don't care how the fuel is produced. What we care about is that it's a drop-in fuel. We have the fleet of today, which in some cases we've been steaming for 40 years already. And the ships and the planes that we're buying today will be steaming for another 30, 40 years and flying for another 30, 40 years. Those machines require an energy-dense liquid fuel to perform the mission. So we know we can't go to other sources. We can't just say gas is the right solution. We can't say that some other approaches are the right way to go. We know in order to deploy with the hull forms that we have, with the storage tanks that are on board, the equipment that's on board, it's an energy-dense liquid fuel that we require. Thus, the investment and the time in testing and certifying those possible fuels. Now, excuse me, the Navy has always led the way in switching energy forms. Sail to coal to oil, oil to nuclear. Every time we've done this, there have been naysayers. Every time we've done this, there are people that have said, you don't need to do that. There's plenty of this resource that remains. You're a fool to waste time, effort, and money on this. Every time the Navy's been right, and we're convinced that we're right again. We're leading the way, once again, in energy alternatives. And there are naysayers today. There will be naysayers tomorrow. But we know that this is the right course to steer. And we'll stay the course, because it's a security issue for us. If you take a look at our requirements for the fuels themselves, I mentioned it has to be a drop-in. Well, we also have some other criteria. That drop-in needs to be indistinguishable chemically from the fuels that we're using today. They have to be domestically produced, geographically distributed regionally, so that we're not consuming more energy distributing it than we are in burning it. It has to meet market price. It can't displace food stock, and it can't drive food prices. It also has to meet Section 526 requirements. So we can't produce more, we can't burn more carbon and produce a greater footprint in that than we get out of normal petroleum. That means there are a lot of challenges associated with it. It means that we have to come up with a range of processes and feedstocks distributed throughout the nation so that where it makes sense to produce something from a particular feedstock, we do that. Whether it's from a cellulosic feedstock, whether it's from algae, whether it's from a waste stream, those are all viable candidates, and those are all options that we're looking at and that we hope will pay off. There's no one single thing that we'll espouse as the silver bullet. There's no one single approach that we're going to hang our hat on. We see this as an opportunity for many different businesses to have different approaches and all have success. If we don't consume alternative fuels, we'll continue to burn down the supply of petroleum that we have. We will reach a point that no matter how well we equip the fleet, no matter how new the weapons or systems are on board, if we can't steam them, we can't use them. I don't know any force in the world that scares anyone if they're tied to the pier. It just doesn't work. And so the only way to maintain our mission capability is to develop these alternative fuels to have assured mobility throughout not only the next 5 years or 10 years, but the next 15, 20, 30, and 40 years. The future for us is going to look at more processes and more feedstocks. And I'm sure you may have some questions, and I'll leave those details for the questions that you may have. But we know ultimately this is the way to go. We know ultimately that our oilers in the fleet will be carrying alternative fuels in their tanks. That presents some challenges. Presents some challenges for interoperability with our allies. We've spent 2 years testing hydroprocess renewables to be able to say that it's safe for our aircraft and ships to operate on those because we engineered the fuel, not the fleet. We've spent the time and money and put that investment in place. We don't know yet if our allies are going to accept that investment and that data at face value and receive fuel from our oilers, or if they're going to have to start an independent testing and certification program for their own equipment. We're engaging in dialogue with all of our allies to try to spur that. The Green Fleet demonstration is something that continues to raise awareness for that with our allies, and it's a very valuable tool to do that. The Green Fleet in 2016 will take that a step further. And it's going to be a delicate dance with our allies. Some may balk at trusting us, but they'll have to start their testing now. Ultimately, though, this is where we're going. It's not a political trick. It's not an issue tied to an administration. It's not something that's going to go away. It's an issue that we believe strongly is a national security imperative, and it's a Navy issue. We can't continue to operate without it. And ultimately, the other thing that we have to crack within our service, along with the other services, is culture change. Even if we have assured mobility through diversified sources of energy, and even if we put the most efficient technology in place to be able to reduce our consumption, we have to train our operators to use those resources in a judicious manner. The cheapest barrel of oil is the one that we never burn. But we have to get through to the fleet, both on the aviation and maritime side, to change how we operate. And the example I gave before was, Tomodot, as when we were talking before, is that when I was running logistics support in the 7th Fleet a few months back, during Tomodachi relief efforts, we ran into a situation where our ships had to pull off the line and go 200 miles offshore in order to refuel their tanks. That was because of a number of different complications because of the radiation, the hazard it presented to the civilian mariners, and some restrictions based in the operating area. For 27 hours, a ship that was providing direct relief to the Japanese citizens had to pull away from that affected area to go 200 miles to sea to receive fuel. Our ability to operate more efficiently our ability to burn less fuel during normal operations, maybe 5 years from now, will allow that ship to stay on station an additional day or 2 days or 3 days before it has to pull off the line. That critical difference could save lives in a disaster relief operation. That critical difference in combat operations could leave a missile, cruiser, or destroyer in the box, ready to launch Tomahawks when needed for an additional 2 to 3 days. Every time we pull away to take fuel, we are a mission loss. We can't execute tasking National Command Authority may give us. So we really do believe energy efficiency is combat capability, and alternative fuels will help define that and develop that for us.
Great. Thanks very much, Commander Goudreau. And with that, I'll turn it over for the Air Force point of view.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew, Jim, Senator Warner, General, for giving us the opportunity to have this conversation today. It's great that it's going to support a paper because you're going to hear it twice. Energy is a common thread for all of the services. We bring different capabilities to the fight and to the challenge, but our overarching mission is the same, and that is to protect the security of our nation. So we must have assured, reliable access to fuel supplies, and very much what Jim just said. The intersection between energy security and our economic security is very visible to us in the Air Force. And particularly, we'll talk a little bit about this more later as we talk about the budgets. However, as we see the fluctuation and the volatility of fuel to fuel our missions, we're also seeing the impact then to our budget. And we see it in real time in the year of execution. So when we have talks like this, one of the things we also emphasize, much like the other services, whether it's biofuels or anything else we're doing in the energy space, is we talk about why we fly. And again, and why do we do energy? We do it for the mission. It's for the mission capability. We fly, you know, to provide intel, communications, medevac of our wounded warriors, and transport of all types of cargo to supply our seamen, airmen, and soldiers on the ground. As well, the Air Force is a very large consumer of energy. In fact, we are the largest consumer of energy in the federal government. We consume $9.7 billion worth of fuel and electricity in FY 2011. Of that, most of it was on aviation fuel. We spend 2.5 billion gallons of fuel a year to fuel our aircraft. And that amount of money would be enough to buy almost 80 F-35. So again, when we talk about if we're not spending it on energy, what can we be doing? We can be increasing or enhancing our mission capability and our mission effectiveness. So every dollar we don't spend on fuel is a dollar that we can reinvest in the warfighter. Beyond the dollar, we recognize the fuel volatility. And our example for that we were talking about on the budget is, for us, when we budgeted in the 2011 budget was in 2009. And when we laid those numbers in, we thought fuel was going to cost us $2.37 a gallon. In June of last year, DLA gave us a price increase that took it to $3.93. And then here in January, it did dip a little bit to $3.83. However, that is still a significant year of execution when we sat in 11 budget deficit that we were having to try to make up. As we sit now in 12, we've been running these numbers here recently. We've been looking at staffer days and trying to make sure that we had our statistics as accurate as possible. When we built the 12 budget, apparently what we planned for was about $3.12 a gallon. We're still at $3.73, $3.83 here in January of 2012, so that's a little over $1 billion budget impact. Right now, it's, as Jim mentioned, probably attached to OCO funding, but that OCO funding will eventually go away. We have to figure out how to solve this because we are decreasing our consumption, but the cost of the fuel continues to give us budget deficits in the year of execution. So. Next one is our energy plan. So what are we doing about this? We're looking to try to develop an energy security posture that is robust, resilient, and ready. And as we move towards that, what does robust mean? It is a posture that provides sufficient supply where and when we need that fuel. Resilient is a posture that means we have options, that we can recover from an outage or a shortage or a denial of energy. How would we recover? And then ready. A posture means that we're ready at a moment's notice. Somebody says we need the Air Force, we go. And we go whether it's going to be in an energy efficient way or not, whether the options are there for us or not. And so we have to be prepared to serve the nation as called upon. And then energy security, what does it end up doing? It enables our warfighters. It expands our operational effectiveness and enhances our national security. And to meet these energy challenges, we're looking to reduce demand, increase supply, and change our culture. Again, very much in line with what Jim just mentioned, and if we had an Army counterpart here, they'd be saying something very similar. So.
Absolutely.
So in order to meet that, the fuel goal challenges, the first thing we're trying to do is reduce our overall consumption. We have to get to the smallest energy footprint that we need to be at so that when we look at replacement alternatives or we look what it takes to fly our combat missions, it is not a predominant part of our budget profile. And so we're looking at reducing our energy consumption by 10% by 2015. We're currently at about 4% towards that goal. So it kind of seems like there's a long ways to go. But there's not. As we look at the 2013 budget, the rollout that they just did on the iron as to what are some of the reductions we're having to take just to meet budget, never mind energy, is probably a lot of our ability to get that 10% reduction is going to come, you know, from the iron reduction. That's not what we meant when we said 10%. We meant to fly the same amount of mission here, fly it the next day, that we're trying to get the 10% reduction. And so that becomes part of the culture change, part of making sure that everybody understands hitting an arbitrary number is not what we're looking for. We're looking for getting real fuel efficiencies across similar mission sets from yesterday into the future. And then the second piece will be our alternatives fuel goal. We want to acquire 50% of the domestic aviation fuel via alternative blends by 2016. And at the current consumption levels, that's going to be about 400 million gallons of fuel. So it's still a lot of fuel for us. let's see. The culture change that I mentioned is looking at increasing our communications all the way down to our installation commanders and our airmen. We're looking at media outreach. These types of events provide us opportunities to communicate with a broader audience that hopefully as it goes through our states and our communities, we continue to say the have the same message and that our airmen are getting that as well in their training. We also provided in December an online training module for our airmen so that they could look at types of activities that they could do at home or on the job and supporting the various missions to help us meet our energy reduction goals, whether it's an installation level or aviation fuel. And then when it comes to aviation fuel, one of the best things we have are our airmen. If we can get them to understand the benefits of reduction, the benefits of, or the compatibility of the alternative fuels with their flying missions, they're the best ones to carry the mission. And so in May of 2011, the Thunderbirds aerial demonstration team flew for the first time on a biofuels blend for us. And if that doesn't send a message to every other pilot out there that says, if those guys can do it and there's no impact to mission, you can take a cargo plane, a C-17, a C-130, a KC-135, and it's gonna be okay there as well. So making it part of the training for the pilots has been part of our mission since they're the ones that consume most of the energy. It's also a lesson we're taking from industry. Industry is showing that if you can get it to the pilot level, have them understand, and on the commercial side, it's usually a bottom line, but for us, it's to demonstrate the mission effectiveness. On the commercial side, it's if we don't have to spend that money, we can stay in business longer, we can keep the pilots, it's a bottom line for them. For us, it's about mission capability. Okay, so now we want to look at increased supply. We talked about reduced demand, increased supply. And so the focus on this is going to be to acquire 50% of the domestic aviation fuel requirements via an alternative fuel blend by 2016. Fuels, just like Jim mentioned, have to be drop-in. They have to meet our technical specifications. They have to, which includes our environmental specifications, and they need to be cost competitive. The Air Force is not making any investments in the production of fuels. We are just going to be a ready partner when it can come to market in the commercial quantities, meeting those other specifications. We are a technology watcher in that respect, not a technology leader. We just published an Energy Horizons report that talks about the areas in which we will lead, follow, and watch. And so when it comes to alternative fuels, where will we lead? We want to know that fuel will work with our engines, so that fuel engine interface is something that we're leading in. We led the way on the commercial side for the certification for Fischer Tropes. We established that standard for HRJ certification, and we are now starting on the ATJ, the alcohol to jet or cellulosic fuel certification. We lead in those areas because that is core mission to the Air Force. And where do we follow? We tell the industry that when you bring it to market, we will be a partner. And where do we watch? As new fuels get developed, as production starts to come up to bear and it starts to scale up, that's where we're watching. So very much using the Energy Horizon model that Dr. Mayberry, our Chief Scientist of the Air Force, spearheaded for us. So the other components of it are the three, as I mentioned, Fischer Tropes, HRJ, or alcohol to jet. They're the three that we're looking towards getting certification. For us in the Air Force, Fischer Trope is essentially 100% certified. HRJ, we should have that completed in 2012. And then alcohol to jet, we are in the process of doing the first phase of that. We are moving towards doing the second phase, which if it goes as planned, will be completed by mid-FY14. And I read an article that as I was leaving the office today, it was just applicable, and I was just amazed that I saw it before I left, which talks about alternative fuels and what it means to the Air Force. Much as Jim said, this isn't a gimmick. We're not playing with this. We mean it. You bring it to market. You meet these specifications. We're going to be there. The Ohio Bio Boys, gosh, what an acronym, right? they were the first ones. They had F-16s. They flew on Camelina-derived biofuels on JPA during a training mission. They took off with this blend. Mid-flight, they refilled with a KC-135, a traditional JPA. It's not a biofuel blend. Landed, refilled with the alternative. It's mixed in the fuel. It can be blended. It can be JPA. The pilots don't know it. Our infrastructure doesn't know it. Our engines don't know it. That's what we're talking about. We're making progress, and we're very excited about the progress that industry is making towards that end to help bring this to be a reality for our nation. So then the increase in the other first that we have had is we flew the first transcontinental flight. We flew the first supersonic flight. Again, apparently we conducted a first refueling, and then the Thunderbird's performance here. The Air Force has purchased about 1.3 million gallons of alternative fuels since last year. Of that amount, we mentioned we would need $400 million on an annual basis to meet our goal. But on top of that 1.1 million, we bought about half of it in Fischer Tropes and we bought half of it in HRJ. We're not picking the winners. We're not picking the feedstock. We just want it to meet the specifications for it to come to market, as we mentioned. Again, very much the way the Navy talked about as well. And then there's the partnerships. We're not doing this alone. We are working through CAFI in the aviation community to help make sure that the commercial market is also maturing along these lines. You mentioned, I think, as I was talking to some folks earlier, you know, United, Alaska Airlines, Lufthansa, are just to name a few of the commercial airlines that have already set up routes where they have run or are running on alternative fuels. So we're not the only one. And when you look at the commercial market for aviation fuel, the Air Force is only 11%. Commercial is 81%. We are not going to move the market alone. We need the help of industry, and that's why we do these partnerships. That's why we work with them to certify their fleets. So in closing, there are more, I think, opportunities to increase alternative fuel use and to expand our fuel options, which in turn will help our mission effectiveness and mission capability. We're working with commercial industry and are working with other vendors to look at what the opportunities are for alternative fuels here in the near future. And together, we could probably solve these challenges to bring it to market and make alternative fuels domestically produced a reality for not only the services, but for America to enhance its energy security and in turn, its economic security. Thank you.
Great, Carol Ann. Jim, thanks very much for your remarks here today. I'll open it up to questions here in a second, but I'll remind you as I do to please identify yourself and your where you work. As the moderator, I'll quickly take the first question here, and kind of one thing that comes through a lot in both of yours is that is price, is budgets. You know, the reasons to do this is because down the road you see it as a major factor in the budget. But the truth is, technology is not yet competitive on price for alternative fuels. I wonder, but we know that the technology is developing very rapidly. When do you and your partners see the cost coming down to a price competitive level? Do you see this in the next couple of years or the next decade or whatever?
We would certainly say that absolutely within the next decade. MIT had done a study that projected somewhere between 2018 and 2020 is where biofuels, not alternative fuels as a whole, but biofuels in particular, would reach cost parity with the market without any government intervention. Last year, President Obama directed the Secretary of the Navy to take a look at some options, and Department of Navy, Department of Agriculture, and Department of Energy signed an MOU where a $510 million fund under DPA authority will be used as seed money to work with industry, matching funds from industry, creating approximately $1 billion to do commercial scale up for the market. The money would be used for feedstock investment or capital infrastructure investment for those companies and potentially spur an even sooner parity. We know it's going to happen. We continue to see petroleum increase, and we continue to see alternative fuel prices decrease. Every contract that we've awarded over the last 3 years has decreased almost 50% every single time. It's halved, and it continues to keep dramatically dropping in price as we do repeated contracts and as the other services do the same. I believe they've seen the same cost effect.
I think when we first started looking at, you know, FD, we were probably paying upwards of $200, you know, for the test quantities, upwards of $200 a gallon. And when the last buy, I understand, was at about $26 a gallon. When we look at, again, not picking any one process, but, you know, FD in other countries is really fairly cost competitive. They're probably about the $3.50 a gallon right now. Again, we have our requirements that needs to meet the environmental standards. That said, if there's a technology leap that allows them to produce that in a way that's compliant with 526, we'll buy that too. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, it'll be interesting to see who can come to market meeting all those parameters first. But there's potential, I think, still for all three processes.
I think it's important to emphasize what Carol Ann said too. I mean, the commercial market is going to drive that cost factor. We're starting some of the interest and in some of the initial production, some of the small-scale commercialization for various producers, but as United and Alaska and Lufthansa and Qantas all put significant investments into this, we're going to see the market price drop.
Great. And before I open it up to any other questions, Senator Warner, is there anything that you would like to add?
Well, I've followed this program for some time. First of all, commend technologically, this works.
Sir.
You have established the case, certainly in the eyes of the American public, that this happens central to our national security. The problem, as I see it, frankly, was the Puzzle Palace, where I spent 30 years. And could you give us a synopsis of one thing you think in the next decade, Commander, there'll be the infrastructure there to meet your requirements? Is Congress going to help you between now and that next decade? That's a question I really pose to both of you. Now, what Congress does one day, it undoes the next. Watch this. But we can't undo this. We've got to keep going because of the national security requirements and because of the fact that people are not going to go out there and put their private investment in this,
Senator, I think you're spot on with your assessment of the, we really don't know 1 year to next what that may present. But I think that our assertion and our belief that this is a national security issue, to have assured mobility as petroleum resources decrease, and we can't really count on natural gas or other forms of energy that are abundant in our own country to power the fleet that we have, we still have to have an energy-dense liquid fuel. And we think that that's a strong and compelling argument that will carry the day on the Hill. I think there's increasing support for some of the efforts. Not everyone believes it's the right thing to do. But then again, not everyone will believe it's ever the right thing to do. Some of the things that we've faced in the past or challenges, I think, have been procedural in the manner that the Secretariat pursued some of the funding as far as what oversight was provided. We actually got pretty good feedback from the staffers that took a look at the proposals and said, we agree with what you are trying to do in principle, but we don't like how you tried to do it. And so the Secretariat is engaging actively every single day to move forward, not only with the funding required for DPA, but also for increased use of long-term contracts. One of the things we frequently hear from industry is that if you'll just sign an offtake agreement with us, we'd be happy to invest in the capital infrastructure. And we know that we can't, but when a company gets to the point that they can meet that price, we need to be able to sign those long-term contracts, and I think we're moving closer to being able to do that. The authority's there, it's just not used frequently. The reason that I would say, sir, that we can meet that I know Secretary Mabus set some pretty aggressive goals to use 50% alternative energy by 2020. If we see cost parity coming by 2018, 2020, 2022, somewhere in that ballpark, that's going to drive increased interest in industry. The continued test and evaluation cycle with increasing quantities for buys, not only in our service but other services, I think are going to continue to provide an impetus for industry to develop. And I think the growing commercial requirement, given the taxation within the EU and the impact of the bottom line for flights flying in and out of there, those things all combined in some ways give us a perfect storm in our favor. And maybe we won't get 50% by 2020 because it is a pretty ambitious goal. But I think we'll be able to achieve a pretty significant portion of that, sir.
And I kind of think, you know, having gone through the staff.
Oh,
can you hear? Oh, I'm not sure if it's on.
It's on.
There we go. I think that, you know, when we had Stafford Days, the thing that does resonate with them is energy security. And so, again, that's from the time that Dr. Geis came on board as our Secretary for Energy, that is the way he has framed everything that we do with it for energy. It's for mission effectiveness. And we try to make sure that Congress understands that's why we're making these types of investments. The other thing is that we're also exploring second and third order effects of this alternative fuel. There are suggestions that it burns cleaner, it burns hotter, and mm-hmm. therefore is less damaging to some precious metal material that's used predominantly in our aircraft engine, as well as reduces soot buildup. And so if you can look at second and third order effects and build that into your life cycle cost, fully burdened cost of energy, you might be looking at different price points. The other thing that I would argue is that I think I saw on a slide deck this morning that we're at about, what, $108 a barrel mm-hmm. with projections yep. of this summer, at least here right. in the local area, of fuel going to $5 a gallon.
Yeah.
You talk about 2018. I mean, like I said, when we were building the 2011 budget in 2009, we thought fuel in 2011 was going to be $2.37 a gallon. In 2009. So I think that there's, in working with Congress and then factors outside of Congress will still help us achieve our goals. So.
Sure, you've got one curve that's going up and one curve that's going down.
Absolutely.
So when will those cross?
Yeah, right.
Absolutely. Well, with that, can I open it for questions, please?
I'm George Smith. I'm with American Defense International. Mm-hmm. Committee brought up the Defense Production Act. So we can scratch that a little further.
Yes, sir.
I know the Navy, the It's an ambitious plan, and many of the industry folks think this is a wonderful way to go, a partner sharing agreement. As I understand it, the Navy has some difficulty reallocating funds, mm-hmm. and I'm just curious if that has been resolved and if the program will go forward in FY13.
I think it will. And I reference that, and it really became, in some ways, more of a process foul issue than anything else. When we got feedback from the staffers, they did understand the energy security and the national security issue. We have used DPA authority in the past to build critical infrastructure for the nation based on security requirements and capabilities. And this we see as another very clear example of that type of challenge. We anticipate being able to move forward within the next few years and to be able to provide the funding as planned. The Secretariat, I know, is working every day on that project and continues to give us updates. And I also know that Secretary Hicks and Secretary Fannin Steele are engaged in multiple meetings with industry to spur interest on their side in coordination with what we're doing with the Hill. So I think it will move forward. It's not a done deal yet. There is always a lot of, the devil is in the details, isn't it? But we have confidence that it will come through.
Please.
I'm Anurag from the International Council on Clean Transportation. We have said that issues related with the land use and water must be addressed with respect to biofuels. Is that simply a guiding principle or is it strict requirements?
Requirements on land use.
Land use and agriculture.
And agriculture.
It's been... You know, we really feel it's a strict requirement. You know, we have written into RFPs and RFIs that those are certain criteria, and DLA, Defense Logistics Agency, goes out and executes those buys on our behalf. Navy doesn't actually buy any of the fuel directly, so we give our requirements and our parameters to DLA, who then goes out and executes that contract. And each one of those RFPs has included that language. So the company that replies has to answer those questions, and so we see it as a requirement. Now, when you start to talk 526 impact and what's the carbon footprint associated with production of the fuel, that becomes a very tricky thing because EPA hasn't put out any guidance on what that means. FAA hasn't put any guidance. You know, the governing agencies really have not yet defined what that is. So as of right now, that language is in there for operational buys, which we have not reached the point that we have to tackle. That'll continue to be a challenge. But for agricultural conflicts, that language is in there, and we expect it to be complied with when people compete for the contracts.
I think just to kind of add to that is on 526, you know, there's been conversation on the Hill regarding, you know, trying to make exemptions or maybe not make it apply. And for the Air Force, we're like, long before 526 came along, this was our requirement. The life cycle production of greenhouse gases needed to be less than what traditional fuels were going to be. So you have 526, you don't. These were our requirements beforehand. 526 gives us an additional umbrella in which to enforce those requirements, mm-hmm. but that was always our intent, was not to have a larger greenhouse gas footprint. And I think that in terms of the feedstock, that's why we're not trying to pick, you know, winners and losers on this. And given allowing the diversity of it, we think that that's what the market's going to bear. People can make money selling food, and they can make money on things that are not food stock to make the alternative fuels. I have seen some small companies that when there's in the startup of the production may use some food stocks, but it's for learning so that they can transition then to other feedstock that's not competitive. So I think the technology is there, and we would continue to support that.
Carolyn, I wanted to. You had mentioned Fischer Tropsch before, which, you know, cold liquid or something like that, and that is generally seen as not meeting 526 requirements.
That's correct. And that's why we're not buying it. However, if you could figure out a carbon capture technology to do that, then yes, it would still be something that we'd be interested in doing. And there are companies, at least overseas, and again, our focus is trying to get that domestic production,
mm-hmm.
but
yeah.
having talked to some other entities, that they are working towards trying to see if they can get their FT to comply with 526, and we're like, bring it, you know? If we land in your country and we need it, we'd like to be able to buy it, kind of thing, so.
Got it.
And what's important to recognize as well, each service is pursuing some different paths and testing, but similar and parallel paths. And the Air Force and the Navy are trading data back and forth on the testing that's been done. So NAVAIR trades that with the labs in the Air Force that are doing their testing and certification. And we can do some certification based on similarity. We pursued HRJ first because we thought there'd be a sooner domestic market for that. There are a number of firms that say that they may have a different front engine for fishotropes that may reduce that carbon footprint. They're, the carbon sequestration issue is a big one to tackle, but I mean, ultimately you're going to see all the services pursuing different tests and certifications, sharing the data, and building a larger pool of potential candidates for military use and commercial use.
Mm-hmm. Sure, please.
I'm Maddie Jolinas, I'm JAGS Biofuels. I have a question, it might be academic, I'm not sure. Since the one of the objectives is to reduce the price, the cost, because that translates into the ability to invest it in other more important equipment and material, getting involved, you said we do not want to be technology leaders, we want to be technology watchers. I appreciate that. But if that points out the R&D phase, by being involved in production to some extent, where there is a comparative advantage of military, Navy, or Air Force being able to provide maybe raw material, maybe a plan could be somewhere that cuts out transportation costs. It could be somewhere where basically profit margins and added management costs can be managed internally. All of that reduces price. And I'm just curious why the mandate of not wanting to get involved in production when there could be an actual comparative advantage in getting involved in production in partnership with people who would do it anyway, but would do it in partnership where costs can be leveraged.
Well, for the Air Force, because we're the ones with the pretty strict mandate that we will not be producers, the Air Force looks at it from the perspective of what's our core competencies.
I agree.
Okay? And so I'll give you one example. We also don't want to run our renewable energy. So we have a requirement to have renewable 25% of our energy demand, electric demand, produced by renewable energies by 2025. Well, that's nice, but we don't want to be, in charge of building large solar arrays and operating them and managing them. That core competency belongs with utilities or private sector, not the Air Force. We would have to train and equip people then to do that. That would take them away from core competency tasks. So that is, for us, the fundamental reason why we can't do that. We're charged with, bombs on target kind of scenarios, not, being producers of the fuel. We can buy the fuel. There's entities out there that will sell us the fuel, and that's their core competencies. That's their business models. To bring that production and have it to be profitable, it must be in the industrial sector, the commercial sector, not with the government. We're not in a mode of making money. And so those ventures will probably not turn out as well as they may look today. So.
And along the same lines, we don't view it as a core competency either. We have a mission, and making the fuel isn't our mission. We just consume it to perform the mission. And in other instances where the government has used DPA to spur industry development, we've never run that industry or taken over production capacity for that industry after it has moved out. It's just not what we do, not within the military. And we don't see that as something that we should be devoting our resources to. Now, being involved in spurring the industry because we have a legitimate military requirement for that product, we do see as a valid and legitimate role. But if you think that people cry foul on the Hill because we're involved in DPA, just wait till you see if we're starting to produce fuel on one of our bases. And it's just not somewhere that we're going to go.
Questions?
Yeah, Great.
A quick comment?
Sure.
I just want to comment. My name is Paul Humboldt. I'm from the Army Petroleum Center.
Great.
I just want to comment both on what Jim and Caroline said. The Army, we're the little brother in this case. we only represent about 18% of the department's fuel consumption. So we are following their lead. We are not in the lead. But we are closely in partnership with each of them, with each of those, each of the other services, on qualifying our equipment to use both HRJ, Fischer-Tropsch, and as the Air Force gets a few steps ahead of us again in the alcohol jet, we don't want to get too close to them. But we'll also follow that aspect as well. And by FY13, we'll qualify all of our ground platforms and air platforms to use both HRJ and
do you have a mandate from your own secretary as percentages and a timeline?
We do not have a mandate, sir. We have a goal. And our goal is more in line with the Navy's, and that is we would like to see 50% of our CONUS fuel requirement met by 2020, which is closer to the Navy's. Although yours is global.
Ours is global. Absolutely. Our entire consumption.
So we're sort of a hybrid, so we're thinking that we're part of the Navy.
Although what's important, what's interesting to know too, it's a global requirement, but 50% of our training occurs within 200 nautical miles of the U.S. So as a domestic market develops, there is a tremendous amount of consumption that we would be able to divert towards alternative fuels.
Excellent. Thanks for that interjection. Glad to have another service here as well. That's great. Excellent. Yeah, please.
Paul Winters from the Biotechnology Industry Organization has baited you. You mentioned the second order effects on engine maintenance and their effects on the cost of fuel. Are you considering other factors such as the location of production, distribution, and supply chain?
We actually are more in the, you know, as we start to, you know, take those first steps sometime here in the future towards figuring out that it, yes, it's met all the requirements, and now can we buy it? It's going to be part of probably the rollout decision. You know, which bases we'll be able to convert first, which ones we'll be able to, you know, which mission sets, you know, might be the most economical or productive for us due to location. So I do think that that's going to bear out. And we don't have anybody here from DLA. I've been learning a little bit about these distribution things from DLA as we're starting the planning, because we think we're almost done with the certification. And it's not as though it comes to market tomorrow and then suddenly, you know, we can be ready to do a large buy. We have to do some planning steps. And so we've been talking with DLA about where some of those central, you know, distribution centers might be, what might be the most cost-effective mode of transportation, whether you tanker it in, train it in, or it's, you know, piped in. So we are starting to look at some of those costs as well.
Navy's also looked at that. I think some market forces are going to drive regional production and distribution anyway. The companies that have the ability to produce regionally close to the demand centers are going to be able to come in with a lower cost, and because they'll just have lower distribution costs as part of their production. And if it's a drop-in fuel, it can be put into the existing pipelines and petroleum distribution system. So if DLA is doing long-distance distribution of the fuel, it'll go with the existing pipeline. And so that really becomes the key. And so the companies that break the code on that are going to be the ones that reach cost earlier. We also recognize, though, that even though it may be produced lower than the cost of petroleum to begin with, it's going to be a commodity. It's going to match the market price. It's not something that biofuel or alternative fuel is always going to be $1 a gallon less or $2 a gallon less. We're not going to save money in comparison with petroleum, but it will give us an assured source of fuel that's domestically produced, and that will help dampen the volatility of the overall commodity market.
Gets us off that reliance of fossil fuels.
Yes, sir.
Especially international.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
But I think also in terms of that is, if, again, this is where it comes in, where commercial aviation is so important, is one of the initiatives that the Air Force is looking towards, going towards, is Jet A, and the use of Jet A as, you know, as opposed to JP8, where it makes sense. And why? Because it's like a penny or two cheaper. Okay. But again, when you talk about 2.5 billion gallons, that translates into real savings for the Air Force. And so, you know, if you get biofuels into the commercial market and it helps to, you know, at least keep a fairly stable cost of energy, that's going to be beneficial to us as well.
Ron, please.
Thanks, Andrew. Yeah, Ron Philadelphia, CNA. Getting back to the supply chain issues, a quick question. Can you talk a little bit about the Great Green Fleet and the plans to deploy it? How would you support it? What are you thinking there? Goes forward.
Well, are we talking the 2012 model or the 2016 model?
16.
Okay, 16. You know, that's a great question, and that really becomes where some of our international discussions come into play. Secretary Hicks and I both were on a trip down to Australia and Singapore a couple weeks ago to talk with government officials, military officials, industry contacts, to get a feel for where their industry is going, how robust it will be, how rapidly it's advancing. I'm engaged in discussions with NATO allies at the, on the military side, and also have some meetings coming up with UK military and government officials on the same topics. I think we'll have the fuel to be able to sail away from our shores fully filled up on biofuel and alternative fuel. The trick, and I think we'll be able to fill up an oiler that steams away with them and tops them off as they go away. But we don't traditionally have an oiler that goes the entire way with them. And so we really have to look at where to get it. Currently, DLA buys fuel from about 600 different locations across the globe. And so one of the keys towards 2016 and beyond is engaging in discussions with our allies and finding out what their markets are doing and how they're moving forward. Now, Europe already has a strong incentive to develop alternative fuel markets because of the increased taxation associated with the carbon footprint. The tax on the airlines is just the first step. You're going to see that continue to increase. So there's going to be growing demand there. There's already growing demand in some of the Asian markets because of the routes they fly into Europe and because of some increasing local economic and taxation policies. So we see those markets growing, and we see the key to 2016 being engaged in those discussions and planning appropriately to be able to tap into local growing markets as we move around the globe. And it may not be one fleet that steams around the globe like the Great White Fleet did. It may be a virtual Great Green Fleet where it's a number of strike groups and ARGs that are operating throughout the globe in different areas that not only purchase alternative fuels, but more importantly, operate using more efficient technology so we decrease our consumption. And the Green Fleet will be out showcasing those technologies and our ability to perform more efficiently with greater combat capability while operating on alternative fuels.
And I agree. It's certainly not a showstopper.
No.
A perception.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we've said, that's right. We've said we're going to do it. We haven't told anyone how we're going to do it yet. So I think we're going to hit our mark on how we're going to do it.
Yeah, sure.
I was thinking about the example of talking about the price of biofuel dropping from, say, $200 per gallon down to $26 per gallon.
Yeah.
And wondering if anyone's had a chance to look at those prices and think about how those prices break out into, say, well, what percent of that is responsible for resource costs, physical resources, the feedstocks, the physical equipment, the technological change, the risk to the entrepreneur. Think about how the entrepreneur was faced with less risk that might accelerate the decline in the price. Other question I had was, you know, if it's not going to be cost competitive until maybe 2022, what is DOD doing now, and what else could DOD do to perhaps buy themselves some more time to maybe decrease or maintain it at some level, steady, stable amount, the expenditures on fuel?
Maybe that goes into efficiency as well. So.
Well, it does. You want to ask
Carol? I'm trying to make sure that I'm understanding the essence of the question about it going to 2022, in terms of our keeping an eye on it is, you know, we'll maintain a goal, and we're trying to make a more aggressive goal even within the Air Force is, because we know we'll be ready. That's done. It's a, you know, we have sourced the funding to get through the certification. ATJ is the last little piece that we have, and we're going to be ready by mid-14. So we'll be, you know, what happens between then and 18. And I think it's going to continue to be the volatility of the market pressures that will continue to keep us focused and engaged with industry to see what we can, you know, to let them know we continue to be a willing partner. I think that, you know, in that process, we'll continue to look at, as you say, efficiencies, ways to continue to reduce that footprint. And working with industry, you know, if on Fisher Trucks they can figure out the 526, you know, gives them at least, you know, more time to figure that out. So.
And along those lines, I think really when we start to talk about projections on where cost parity may occur, even the MIT study was done with the most conservative estimates. And they thought between 2018 and 2020, but that assumed a lower price for petroleum, that assumed a higher price for the alternative fuels. We've seen those costs drop dramatically, I think because the R&D costs for the companies were loaded into those initial contracts. And so we're starting to get multiple deliveries from companies where we're seeing production costs, not capital infrastructure investment costs and R&D costs that they've had to recoup. You know, granted, they haven't fully amortized those costs and recouped those costs yet, but we've seen some of the big chunks up front. We're going to continue to see more companies come through with smarter technology, better approaches. We're seeing electrofuel development. We're seeing pyrolysis. We're seeing different biologic methods. And there's such a range of different things that are close to breaking through that we know that a number of them are.
I think the other piece is that, you know, some firms at least have come talk to us are taking this, you know, crawl, walk, run type of approach where they're starting with, you know, certain types of, you know, biofuels that, you know, might run on different types of applications. And then they'll take it to ethanol, and then they're like, our next step will then be jet fuel. So they're starting, you know, a plant that's, you know, fairly small, but with plans, capability, and land in order to be able to grow it out, you know, to do the full production. And they're looking in a, you know, 3 to 5 year horizon. They're not, you know, we're not looking 10, 15 years out. So I think it's still very promising.
And at the same time, the cost for oil is going to continue to increase. The production costs, just because of the reduced amount of product in the fields, is going to increase. Even some of the marginal products that we take a look at, whether it's tar sands or, you know, tight oil or any of the other different products, strictly the cost associated with pulling that out of the ground is more expensive than pulling something out of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is spending more to maintain those fields and pull that out of the ground. And if you take a look at the OPEC producers, it's not just the cost of production. It's the break-even cost because they tie their social programs and balancing their national budget to the sale of each barrel. The Arab Spring has brought a different dynamic into it where it's going to take more social programs and support within the countries to do what they need to do to continue to govern. That break-even cost is continue to increase, driven by production costs and social support costs. That dynamic is just going to grow. At the same time, it's purely reducing resource. All of those combined, I mean, we think we're going to continue to see the types of increases in price that we have seen.
Well, I think we're coming up on 1 o'clock here. So if you all, Carolyn, or Jim, if you have any final thoughts, any final ideas for what ASP should be focusing on in our upcoming white paper on this, this is your chance.
I think it's, you know, for us, it's taking a look at perhaps all of the additional opportunities that going towards a biofuel market would bring to us. And it's not, again, not just for the, a military application, but commercial applications. And how do we, you know, pull those resources together as a nation in order to be able to bring biofuels to production in a more timely manner.
Agreed. And also, you know, potentially a lot of the discussion, if you talk to industry, the price for the fuel hinges upon the feedstock the company picks. In so many cases, it's not necessarily the technology that drives it. I mean, if it's a huge FT plant and gutter, yeah, that's going to drive some of their cost. But for more modest commercialized plants, it's the feedstock that drives their cost. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, really understanding the feedstocks and the processes that are available is going to be the key to coming up with a product that's usable.
Great. And I guess one last question, some of the jokers here in the office were asking, does it smell like fried chicken when you fire an F/A-18 off the deck?
No french fries, no fried chicken. It smells like fuel.
That's right.
Tastes like it too.
Well, great. Well, with that, if you all could join me in thanking our speakers here. And keep an eye out in your email for an upcoming paper on this. So, thank you.
That's great.
Thanks, sir.
This is first class.
Hey, Andrew, one thing to keep your eyes open on, too.
Sure.
We're sponsoring a symposium up at MIT in September.
Okay.
It's going to be an alternative fuels symposium at MIT.
Cool.
Taking a look at a lot of these different issues and pulling industry and academia.
Excellent.
So probably a two-day symposium.
That'll be a
wonderful session.
Good.
Wonderful session.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah, Carol Ann, thanks so much.
Hey, and you know, I just wanted to interrupt you.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Absolutely.
Price Mary. And you mentioned Carrie DeLand.
Thank you.